Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is election day after a year and a half. Here we are. And just think, tomorrow at this time, we'll be doing a show on what happened today. Hope you voted. We'll vote, and we'll talk all about the results tomorrow. We have a lot going on for the next 2 hours. This first hour of the program, the nation is becoming a minority majority, and we have seen immigration as a major issue in this presidential election. The evolving face of U.S. immigration, the makeup of the U.S. electorate, hour one of our program, and how it's going to become even more significant in the years ahead. Also during the first hour, we're going to be checking in hour one and hour two with Wisconsin Public Radio reporters who are around the state, and will let us know what voter turnout is like, give us some comparisons with previous presidential elections, and also discuss if there are any problems at the polls or interesting people they've met along the way. So we'll have reporters from Milwaukee and from La Crosse and Wausau and Eau Claire. So that's coming up both hours of the program. Hour two, we thought it would be, because everybody said how contentious this election has been, that we would look at other times that were hard for us. We weren't alive during these years, but they were hard times in American history. So we will talk about Reconstruction, what a time that was. We will also be looking at economic boom after World War II, and then a downturn, and the economy, and whether or not any presidential candidate can make a promise that he or she will be able to give us a boost in our incomes. We'll talk about that. And Julian Zelizer will be here too. He knows about so many different elections. We've asked him to concentrate on the wild times of the 1960s, and particularly 1968. So both hours, you're welcome to join us. We're not electioneering here today, but we are talking about some major issues. Immigration, as I said, the first hour of the show. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. As part of the Associated Press's ongoing exploration of the economic, social, and political divisions in American society, done by Associated Press, Josh Boak is with us today, and he has done writing about this. He wrote a very interesting piece, What is the Face of U.S. Immigration?, and says that immigrants to the U.S. are more likely to come from Asia than from Mexico or Latin America. Immigrants today are disproportionately well-educated and entrepreneurial. We're going to be talking with Josh, the first part of our program today. He's an economics writer at the Associated Press. Before that, he was working for the Fiscal Times as deputy D.C. bureau chief and a reporter at Politico, and also a researcher for Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars. Josh, hello. Happy Election Day, Josh.
Happy Election Day to you, Kathleen.
It's almost over, Josh. I know, it's been a long, long haul. I thought that the series Divided America was really interesting, and what you write really defies what most of us think about immigration, that immigrants, you write, are coming from Asia more than Mexico or Latin America. A number of immigrants are coming here from India, and you start one of your pieces with a young woman from India who's in North Carolina, I believe.
That's exactly right. When we started looking at what the data really told us was happening, we saw a very different story about immigration than what voters were hearing about from people seeking elected office. And what we saw was that basically since 2010, a greater portion of immigrants to the United States were coming from Asia, and a greater share of them had graduate degrees. And this was really, really important, because if we look, for example, at the Indian immigrant population, which has been very large in certain pockets of this country, the median household for that family tends to be about, the median household income tends to be double the U.S. median. So it's more than $100,000 a year. So we're actually bringing in wealthier immigrants disproportionately than we used to several years ago.
Mm-hmm. And why is that? Do you know?
There's several reasons. One is that we have a series of universities that are bringing foreigners in. A second thing is that a lot of lower-skilled immigrants left the United States and began to depart after the recession. And then, perhaps most importantly, immigration laws have increasingly preferenced better-educated immigrants coming to this country. It's kind of this global competition for talent, and the United States is part of that competition.
And in terms of the stereotypes, I think that they would include that most of the immigrants are coming from Mexico or coming from Latin America in very huge numbers. You remind us that a number of people have already been deported back to countries, but our idea about what is actually happening is not what is actually happening.
That's exactly right. In a sense, kind of what really began to happen is that India and China, around about 2013, became the leading sources of immigration rather than Mexico. We still have a fair number of Mexican immigrants living in the United States, and many of those immigrants, those who are here legally on visas, those who are U.S. citizens, and even those who are here unauthorized, also live in some communities that are very different than what most people think. For example, down in North Carolina, there's Duplin County, whose population had been flat or stagnating. It's a rural county filled with tobacco fields. And in the 1990s, it was really the arrival of those Mexican immigrants that boosted the population and actually kept that local economy alive based on the interviews that we did.
Mm-hmm. And what about American sentiments, or let's ask North Carolinian sentiments toward those workers and also to some of the Indian and Chinese immigrants that have come in? Are they negatively held views, or are they positively held views, or somewhere in the middle?
It's often somewhere in the middle. What we see when we look at polling data and break it down by crosstabs is that there is a political and ideological divide increasingly on how people view immigrants. Voters who tend to be whiter, voters who tend to be more Republican, are less favorable toward immigrants, whereas voters who are more likely to be minorities or Democrats or college-educated are more favorable toward immigrants. So that's really the core of the divide.
Are you surprised that this issue has been front and center, along with a couple others, during this election cycle?
In some ways, yes. In other ways, no. I think that a lot of Americans have anxieties about very clear demographic changes in our country. And immigration is reflective of one of those massive demographic changes. We have the greatest share of immigrants living in the United States as a whole in roughly a century. And so it would be strange if that didn't bring these matters to the forefront. I think where things get a little bit surprising is when we start looking at the facts and the breakdown in terms of who's coming and what the actual trends are, that seems not to have had as much of a role in the public debate about what the best policy is. In a sense, this election thus far has merely debated the existence of immigrants instead of what are the best policies for the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the number of immigrants in states like California and New York. Educated Chinese immigrants, I didn't really know this, that their numbers have really exploded over the past 4 or 5 years. Why are they coming here?
There's a number of reasons why. Some are coming from schooling. Others are wanting to locate assets in the United States rather than in China. An economist I spoke to talked about one of the best ways to look at kind of where these Chinese immigrants are going is when they buy real estate, the electricity usage. Some of them are literally just parking their money in houses in the United States and buying those assets.
Hoping that they'll turn them when?
That the homes appreciate in value or that the homes simply provide a store of value. It's almost like a safe haven if you're an investor.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have, in a sense, is you've had this pull toward California because it's the most accessible from China for that group of immigrants. But in the long run, the broader trend is that once you get immigration filtering in, it starts in kind of these major hubs like California or New York and then flows through the rest of the country. And so these states are really on the leading edge of that trend.
Hmm.
At some point, we'll see more high-educated Chinese immigrants all around us.
Interesting. You write in the piece that economists view immigrants as helpful, even essential, for the nation's continued prosperity. An aging U.S. population is causing more retirements, and most economists say immigrants are needed to increase the workforce to sustain overall growth. All immigrants are welcome? People who are more educated are more welcome than those who are not, or everybody is needed?
So when we talk about economists tend to view the world differently than, say, you or I would. And economists are talking about the net benefits. In other words, they're calculating the trade-offs, and there are trade-offs, right? There are Americans who've lost their jobs due to how we structure our immigration programs. We're going to see that, but economists on the whole say immigrants are positive, especially on the high end, because they're less of a cost to taxpayers, but even in some cases on the low end, you have communities where you would think that workers looking for jobs might want to go, but we haven't seen them turn up in these rural communities, and as a result, we've seen a higher share of lower-skilled immigrants. This was especially true in the 1990s, move into agriculture and construction and some of those areas.
Mm-hmm. Many would argue that it's long past time for us to look seriously at our immigration policy and to deal with the issue of immigration reform. We just have one heck of a time doing that. It seems to be so hard for us. No hope, really, that it's going to become any easier as the time goes on, or maybe you disagree with that. Why is it so hard to come up with a policy that will be sensible?
Well, for one thing, there's a lot of visa programs. There's a lot of competing needs and interests. A lot of people that I've spoken to would say that they want to open up our immigration to ensure that we have this continued flow of highly educated workers into the United States, and that that is a relatively uncontroversial aspect of immigration reform. But then there's questions of amnesty for people who are here without visas, for people who cross the border without authorization. And that becomes a major sticking point in terms of getting all the reforms together. And even then, we're still talking about a highly complicated and nuanced set of policies where you're trying to balance the best interests of workers, of companies, and the country as a whole regarding who it brings in. And that's more of an art form than a science. But again, we haven't even gotten to that point in this election where we're having this debate about the best policies. Much of the focus on immigration has been in a political trajectory regarding Hillary Clinton and her identifying more and more with the Latino community, and Donald Trump promising very early on in his campaign to build a wall on the Mexican border.
Mm-hmm.
The actual nuances and what it takes to enforce a policy and judge outcomes just hasn't been as big a focus in the discussion.
And what about, this obviously is significant to America, and I'm wondering how it translates into political concern, about identity concern, about a whole host of issues. The Latino vote in 2016, a significant growth in the number of Latino eligible voters, helping to make the U.S. electorate more racially and ethnically diverse than ever. I've heard that among people who are 5 years old and younger, it is majority-minority in this country. That's a transition for the country. How does it play out in terms of voting, in terms of how we treat our neighbors, in terms of both of those?
Well, this is one of many transitions that our country is going through demographically, right? So we have an increasingly diverse nation, and that's due to immigration, but that's also due to birth rates and interracial marriage.
Mm.
Secondly, we have an increasingly diverse country when it comes to education and the differences between the economic fortunes of someone with a college degree and someone without a college degree. And then lastly, we see a growing divide with regard to age. We have baby boomers entering retirement age, just as we have millennials starting to come into the economy, and they haven't quite yet, but they soon will, starting around the 2020 election, begin to enter the phase where they're buying homes en masse and starting to move to also peak voting rates.
Mm-hmm.
But, so three big divides.
But at that moment, at this moment, the younger millennials have not entered the voting booth as often as we thought they might. They're still not a huge block, are they?
Well, I mean, this is one of the big questions, right? They're the largest generation, and I think this election will help to tell us about how much they've entered in. But they haven't gotten to the traditional age in the first place where they would traditionally vote, right? So millennials tend to be 34 or younger, but the bulk of them tend to be between the age of 25 and 21 right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that group is still coming up, and what that group does next will be really kind of important for the policies that our society adopts.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that immigration reform is something that the next Congress and the next president is going to be able to take on?
That's a tough question because it's a political question. And certainly if you're a Democrat, on the one hand, you run on the promise of immigration reform, but if immigration reform isn't passed, you're able to use it as a cudgel against your political opponents. If you're a Republican, you might see in the long term your interest for getting immigration reform. Certainly that was one of the ideas that Florida Senator Marco Rubio had several years ago when he partnered on that that deal. And yet what we've seen is that the base Republican voter is animated by the idea of tighter immigration controls.
Right.
And so, you know, the question is how do you get those incentives to align, and whether the public cares enough about the issues to pressure lawmakers to a compromise and agreement. And again, this country in many ways seems to be increasingly divided on immigration issues.
Mm-hmm. We have time to welcome a couple phone calls for you if you'd like to join our conversation. We're doing a lot of things the next couple hours, actually, because it's election day. So we thought we would focus on one of the more contentious issues of this race, and it concerns immigration, clearly an issue that Congress has not wanted to deal with for some time now, and that maybe we'll see some action in the next Congress, and maybe we won't. But it certainly has become front and center, probably because of Donald Trump's discussion about immigration, and we're looking at what immigration patterns are in this country. Surprisingly, a large number of immigrants coming from China and from India, highly educated people. And we're also looking at the changing nature of the United States. We've already heard, and we'll talk more about it with our next guest, about Latino vote in the country and early Latino vote, which is calling some people to already call certain states for the Democrats, actually, because of the early voting among Latinos. We'll spend more time talking about that. And we're also this hour going to be speaking with two Wisconsin Public Radio reporters who have been keeping an eye on the polls in the state of Wisconsin. So we'll branch beyond Milwaukee and do that the next hour and a half. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join this conversation, and the email is talk@wpr.org. We have reporters in Milwaukee, Wausau, La Crosse, and where else are we going? Milwaukee, Wausau, La Crosse. Let me just check here, because if you're in and Eau Claire. How could I forget Eau Claire? Beautiful Eau Claire. So if you're in other parts of the state, we would like to hear from you, too. If you want to call in and let us know how turnout is in Green Bay, how turnout is in Janesville, we'd like to hear from you during the course of our conversation. So we are going to check with Milwaukee here in just one moment, and we want to thank Josh so much for being with us. This will be a continuing story, Josh. I hope you'll join us in future conversations, non-election day, and we can see what we do about this issue.
It would be an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Josh. Josh Boak writes for the Associated Press, the piece that caught our attention, Divided America, the Evolving Face of U.S. Immigration. It's part of the Associated Press ongoing exploration of the economic, social, and political divisions in American society. We're going to continue with the Dean and Distinguished Professor of Education at UCLA. Will be joining us momentarily. He is Marcelo Suarez Orozco, and we'll be looking at Latino early turnout in the country. We'll also look at it. Still, it looks as though Latinos are not going to be voting in huge numbers, although we don't know at this point. But Latino vote has been important for early voters, and some states have already been called because of the number of people who have turned out. But is it? How big is it? And will it only get larger? And why is it that it's not a huge number right now? Professor Marcelo Orozco will join us in just a few moments. And you can join us, too. Our number is 800-486-8655. So we want to find out what's going on in voting places all over the state of Wisconsin. And to do that, we have a great radio news team here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're going to check in with a couple people this hour and a couple people next hour. We'll look at Milwaukee, biggest city in the state, in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're checking in with reporters to find out how things are going around the state on this election day. Kyla Calvert-Mason is joining us in our Milwaukee studios. She is WPR's assistant news director stationed here in Milwaukee. She also covers education here, and she's been visiting Milwaukee polling places this morning, looking at early voting turnout in Milwaukee and also looking at the support for Donald Trump in these all-important, and these people in these counties voting in huge numbers, record numbers, almost some of the highest voter turnout in the whole country, actually. So she's going to give us the lowdown on what's going on so far. Kyla, hey, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So the voting, early voting, everybody's been looking at that all over the country. It is very large in Milwaukee.
There were more than 52,000 voters in Milwaukee who cast their ballots early across the state. It was 800,000 voters who voted early, which is a record for the state. And, you know, that was driven largely by the larger cities, you know, Democratic counties like Dane and Milwaukee County. So, I mean, it's huge. They expect about 3 million people to vote in Wisconsin today. So that's nearly a third of the voters.
And do we know, maybe we won't know until after the election, when we look at the number of early voters, I voted early for the first time in my life. I love to go to the polls, but things were busy. When you look at the trend, it looks as though more people are voting early. Is that just a natural progression of how we're voting, or is it a result of this particular election? Do we know?
I don't think we do, but I mean, I think you look at every area of our lives, and more we expect to be able to do everything on our own time and to choose when we do everything.
Right.
So I think that that translates to voting, and across the country where early voting is available, the numbers just keep increasing, like you said.
So. Yeah. What about the turnout in traditionally and heavily Republican, the Wild counties?
I don't know that we've heard that much about what, you know, what turnout is looking like in the Wild counties. I did see that there were, you know, long lines in places like Brookfield today, which is in, you know, one of the ring counties. And I think it's, you know, that's an area where Donald Trump has struggled this year. It's a conservative bastion, but he was not well received there. Charlie Sykes, you know, influential conservative voice in the state, never put his support into Trump. And, you know, when he was leaving, when he announced he was leaving his show last month, I think he announced that he'll be leaving. You know, he said that this election wasn't part of why, it wasn't why he was leaving, but, you know, it made him feel good about the decision he had made earlier to sort of bring an end to his day-to-day radio presence.
Mm-hmm. So, is there any way to know, when you look at Milwaukee and we look at the state of Wisconsin, I mean, we went for Ted Cruz and we went for Bernie Sanders. You know, there weren't a lot of states that did just that, and not by a little amount, by a lot, mm-hmm. you know, in both mm-hmm. cases. Can you glean anything from that when it comes to a presidential vote? Do people naturally, if you're a Republican, if you're a Cruz voter, go to Trump? Will Sanders voters go to Clinton?
It seems to me that from what we've heard, there has been more, supporters of Bernie Sanders have embraced voting for Hillary Clinton maybe more than voters for Ted Cruz embraced voting for Donald Trump. But, you know, I think we'll see at the end of the day today mm-hmm. how that all shook out.
Yeah. The other, of course, important race, although there are a lot of other issues going on in the state, but the Senate race is big as well. Craig Gilbert had an interesting piece in today's Journal Sentinel. Wisconsin Democrat Russ Feingold trying to defeat the man who cost him his U.S. Senate seat 6 years ago. I didn't realize it was this long ago. The last time someone pulled that off was 1934.
Wow.
Isn't that something?
It
1934.
Is.
So this is a tall task. This race appears to be, I don't know if you've seen any new polls, but it appears to be just very, very close.
Yeah, I mean, that's what last Marquette poll out last week, you know, basically just showed it neck and neck. They had Feingold up 1 point, and that's statistically a dead heat.
So. So that means tonight, reporters across the state will be looking, you'll be looking, I would imagine, at certain counties to figure out where that race is going, and even more so than maybe equally as much the presidential race. What are you looking at? What counties?
Well, I think that, you know, the large population centers are going to be what drives the results, and, you know, it's going to be a late night for all of the reporters, I think, because it's going to take a long time for races that are close like this to be decided. So it's just going to depend on where the votes are getting counted mm-hmm. earliest and, you know, where we're hearing from.
Yeah. Any problems that you've heard in Milwaukee today or not?
You know, I was out at some polling places this morning. It was very smooth. There were a couple of, you know, pretty insignificant lines. There were people registering at the polling places without problem. I talked to some observers from a nonpartisan nonprofit that, you know, does poll watching every election cycle. And those observers said to me that it was the same everywhere they went, that there were, you know, in every place, a few people who came and didn't have their ID, either because they forgot it at home or didn't realize they needed one. But by and large, you know, no significant problems with a lot of voters not being prepared for the ID requirement. From what I saw and what I heard from these observers and what I've heard from our reporters around the state, there's none of this sort of confrontational poll watching that we've been, you know, told to anticipate across the country. So that's not really happening in Milwaukee that I've heard or know of thus far. One of the chief inspectors that I talked to this morning in Sherman Park, he told me that they saw a lot more of that actually in 2008 when Obama was first elected. So it's been a very quiet morning for most of the polling places in Milwaukee.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Kyla, for being with us. We're going to check in with other Wisconsin Public Radio reporters. And we do want to remind everybody that we have really, really good election coverage. Obviously, the presidential race will be something that National Public Radio will be covering thoroughly. We're going to them completely at 10 o'clock. And we're starting our coverage when?
I believe it starts at 6:30 or 7. The Capitol Bureau Chief, Sean Johnson, will be on with Frederica Freiberg, and they will go until 10, depending on whether the Senate race is still very tight then. They may go until 11, and we'll be with NPR until 4 a.m.
Are you serious?
Yes.
4 a.m.? No 4 sleep at all?
Well, it'll be not for the national people. Hopefully, hopefully our reporters will have gone home by then.
I didn't know it was that long. 4 o'clock in the morning. Oh, my gosh. What a way to end a year and a half campaign, right?
Well, they're prepared to bring you the whatever news is available at 4 a.m.
Yeah,
so.
And somebody will give them food,
yeah,
which will be important. Thanks, Kyla, very much. We're going to be checking in later this hour. We'll be going to La Crosse. Hope Kerwin will be joining us. Kyla Calvert-Mason is here in Milwaukee, where she covers education and is assistant news director. If you want to tell us how things are going in other parts of the state, we have time to take a few phone calls. What we do know about Madison so far, it's, of course, a very Democratic area. Early voter turnout in Wisconsin saw a record high, including Dane County, where early voting started as early as late September. Madison opened 13 early voting locations and brought in staff from other departments to assist the city clerk's office with absentee ballots. So it looks as though early voting there is quite heavy, and there have been visits by Joe Biden and Tim Kaine in the last week to campaign for Hillary Clinton. Ron Johnson crisscrossed the state Saturday with Paul Ryan and Scott Walker, including a stop in Madison. Okay, on we go. We're focusing on issues that have been important, and we're going to be talking more about the U.S. becoming minority majority in the not too distant future and look at Latino vote. Joining us now is Professor Marcelo Suarez or Rosco. He's the Dean and Distinguished Professor of Education at UCLA. He was co-director of the Harvard Immigration Project and Immigration Studies at NYU. He's the author of Transformations, Immigration, Family Life, and Achievement Motivation Among Latino Adolescents, contributed to the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, CNN, and the list goes on. Professor, hello. Thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about early vote here, Latino vote, early vote in 2016. Everybody's saying this could be the story of the election if indeed Hillary Clinton is elected president. Is there a huge mobilization of Latino vote, or is the press making too much of it?
Well, the data really shows something new and a momentum that we haven't seen before. If you take a number of sort of the critical toss-up states, if you take Florida, the data as of this morning showed an increase of almost 130%.
Oh, my gosh, that's huge.
In early Latino voting. If you look at Georgia, over 140% If you look at North Carolina, over 75%. So here, this is what the data show. 50-plus million Latinos in our country today, about 27.3 million can vote, are eligible to vote. And the question will be, and we'll know by the end of the day, whether, in fact, this will be the election where the so-called sleeping giant, the Latino sleeping giant, woke up and went to the polls and made a decision that influences the future of our country.
Yeah. So do you assume they're voting for Hillary Clinton in more numbers than Donald Trump?
Well, so historically, over the last generation, about 20 years, Republicans did well with the Latino voters. George W. Bush got 40% of the Latino vote. Of course, moving forward, then Barack Obama really made extraordinary inroads, getting approximately 70-plus percent of the Latino vote. So the early polling suggests that Latinos are going back to the Democratic Party. They're supporting Hillary Clinton in greater numbers, and we see a lot of new things. We see changes in patterns of Cuban voting. Historically, mm-hmm. Latinos really divide. Latinos are not a monolith, right? The Latinos are many, many things, and historically, different subgroups tended to vote in different ways. We see greater momentum today for the Democratic side of the ticket.
Yeah, which I guess would be natural considering some of the comments that Donald Trump made. I did hear a report somewhere this morning on television. I've been watching way too much of this for too many days. But somebody was citing a poll from a major Mexican newspaper that showed that 95% of the people in Mexico were in favor of Hillary Clinton. That's huge, 95%.
That's the Mexicans in Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be as high here, but I suspect that by the end of the day, we're going to see something very similar to the Obama coalition.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you used to have a reliable Cuban-American coalition in Florida that voted reliably Republican for a long, long time. Is that changing? And if so, why?
So again, the data seem to suggest that there's a generational shift here, that the younger Cuban Americans are behaving in ways, voting-wise, that are different from the way their parents and their grandparents voted. And I think this has to do with the general millennial generational change. I think that the Cubans were very, very focused on the issue of U.S.-Cuban relations. And I think the younger Cubans have, and I would say this is true of all Latinos. I mean, Latinos are not from the other side of the moon. In terms of their voting behavior, they behave like everybody else. The issues that sort of concern Latinos really have to do with issues relating to jobs, wages, health care, security, education, and also immigration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you insult, you know, 50 million Americans, they're not going to vote for you. And that's, I think, what the data are showing so far.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about their feelings about Democrats and President Barack Obama, who also deported a record number of people?
Right. So I think that the level of enthusiasm in this election, paradoxically, is lower than in the first Obama election. At the same time, there is this this ambivalence and this concern that under a Democratic administration, we've deported over 4 million people. And, you know, these are families. These are, this is your, right, your abuelita. This is your, these are your cousins or your, for Latinos, you know, immigration is politics, but it's also biography. It's your relatives. It's, mm-hmm, it's folk you're close to. And, the deportations piece is a piece that I think might have been an undertow in terms of what could have been a really a historic, a transformational Latino moment in U.S. politics. But regardless, I think that the early data show the sleeping giant woke up. Woke up early this morning. I was here in L.A. voting at 7 o'clock in the morning. I went to the voting, and it's amazing the lines of
really?
People. And what was amazing is, you know, multiple generations, so the grandpa and the grandma and the kids, and everybody was, you know, in their Sunday best and eager to do their civic duty. And, you know, we can't tell who they're going to vote for, but regardless, this will be a historic moment for our country moving forward.
I love to vote, don't you? I just love the whole thing. I love getting dressed up in a certain way on election day and having people over. And
I do, too. I do, too. I was born in Argentina. I never voted because it was a military dictatorship. Aww. And, you know, I became a U.S. citizen, and I love to get up early, drive to the polls, and go through the ritual and get my I voted, you know.
I love that. I know. The I voted sticker.
Yeah, whoever thought of
that.
It's a ritual that is magic, and, you know, you can't take it for granted. You know, many, many countries don't have what we have, which is the peaceful transition of power, which is huge. That's what it's at the heart of the democratic promise.
Yeah. Our phone number, if you'd like to join this conversation, we're talking about the country becoming majority-minority. We're talking about the Latino explosion and see how that plays out tonight. The early voting, we already know there's been a heavy Latino vote. And our guest this part of the show is Professor Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He's the Dean and Distinguished Professor of Education at UCLA. He was co-director of the Harvard Immigration Projects and Immigration Studies at NYU. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have time to take a few calls for him. Before we go to La Crosse, we have reporters, WPR reporters, who have been keeping an eye on voting in various places in the state. And so Hope Kerwin will be joining us, our news reporter in La Crosse, who's been doing some interesting reporting today. But on the subject of immigration, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. As I asked our earlier guest, do you have faith that we're going to deal with this issue of immigration reform in this country in any kind of way that's serious and bipartisan in the next 4 years, or are you not very optimistic?
So that's a $64,000 question, and this will depend on how things turn out in the Senate and in the House.
Mm-hmm.
Does the next president have a pathway to make a deal where we can deal with the fact that we have 11 million folk that have no papers? And obviously the two candidates have suggested very, very different pathways moving forward. The Clinton administration has alluded or suggested that they will work towards getting a comprehensive immigration reform legislation through the Congress. Clearly, she will need partners in the Congress to pass that bill. And I think Trump has indicated a very, very different pathway moving forward. So I think a lot of, clearly the top of the ticket is the most important significant issue here, but secondly, what happens in the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about young people for a moment. We forget about them, and they played a major role, certainly, in the enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. Millennials, I understand, make up 44% of Latino-eligible voters. So this huge group of people, the biggest group of any demographic in this country, will pretty soon be in power. And I'm wondering, You talk about the Latino explosion. That number is really going to explode, and people are going to be influential people, some in public service. What's that going to do for this democracy? All these young people who voted for Bernie Sanders and these young minority people who will soon become majority people in the country. It's a big shift.
It is a big shift indeed. We, our country, will be the first major advanced democracy in the world that will be minority-majority. I'm calling you from Los Angeles, a state, California. We are, of course, already minority-majority in mm-hmm. California. But this is the future of our country moving forward, and the story is the fastest growing sector of the U.S. child, youth, and emerging adult population now is children of color. It's really the Hispanic population, the Latino population, the Asian population. By the way, today, the fastest growing sector of the population, the immigrant origin population in the United States, is Asian. It's not, proportionally speaking, it's not Latino. So we're facing a transition. We're facing a demographic transition where the only sector of the young population that is growing are Latinos, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, Afro-Caribbeans back east, and that will be the face of our future moving forward. Mm. More diverse than ever, very engaged civically. We see this in the ambitions, in the interest of young people. They're very engaged in this election. By the end of tonight, we're going to see numbers that are, I think, going to show the direction of the country moving forward. So it is the United States is the future of our country. In no small measure will depend on these new younger Americans that come from ever more diverse backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
We see it in our high schools. We see it in our
yes.
colleges. We see it in see it in our neighborhoods. We see it in the churches. We see it in the soccer fields, the baseball fields. So it's we've been here before. 150 years ago, the fastest growing sector of the U.S. population were the immigrants from Europe.
Right.
There were the new arrivals from, you know, the Mediterranean. There were the Irish. There were the Italians. There were the Eastern Europeans. So, unlike other countries, we have a long history of this. And today we're seeing a lot of optimism. A lot of the Latinos are healthier. They tend to have less physical and other issues. They tend to be more optimistic about the future.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to want to be engaged in civics. And I think that's what we're going to see today. We're going to see a significant growth mm-hmm. in young Latino voters.
And yet you remind us of the history. We're talking about difficult times in American history, Reconstruction, and particularly 1960s and 68 election. During those times of great transition, this country has been in upheaval, hasn't it? I mean, it's just been an upheaval. So it's a long history, a wonderful history in some ways, but the pushback and the difficulty with major changes is something we can't ignore.
No, we can't. And every time, at every turn, we see a very similar story. The way I put it is, you know, we love immigration looking backwards. We love the stories of our...
We love ourselves, right?
ancestors, our German ancestors
sure.
that settled in Wisconsin. We love the story of our Italian, Irish,
yes.
Scottish. In the here and now, immigration always generated pushback and concern. This was true 100 years ago. This was true 150 years ago when the Germans were coming into our country, when they were going into Milwaukee and into Madison. Benjamin Franklin's famous line was, you know, we're never going to assimilate them. We're never going to teach them English. The famous phrase was, we can't Americanize them. They're going to Germanize us. And
right.
now we look
right.
back and we see how misguided those concerns were, meaning over time and across generations, three things happened. First, immigrants deeply, deeply connect with the U.S. labor market. If you're in the U.S. and you're an immigrant, you're working, and you're working for a better tomorrow for yourself, for your family, for your society. The second point we see is a very fast movement towards English language dominance. Mm-hmm. This happened with the Germans. This happened with the Italians. And one of my colleagues at Harvard once said, well, you know, the U.S., we are a cemetery for languages. The Germans brought German. The Swedish brought Swedish. The Japanese brought Japanese. And we bury those languages in our country, right? This is true today. In fact, Hispanic kids here in L.A. today are learning English faster than, say, Italian kids were learning English in the Lower East Side of New York, in Red Hook, in Brooklyn, 100, 150 years ago. And the third piece that is uniquely American, especially when we see what's happening in immigration in other parts of the world, is that immigrant groups over time tend to marry outside their own ethnicities. You know, if you're a Latino in New York in the first generation, about a third marry outside their own group. So when you look at the labor market, when you look at language, when you look at intermarriage, the story remains very consistent. Over time, immigrants make the transition, and, you know, we eat better, we dress better, we dance better. But in the here and now, we're always concerned. We're always concerned. This was true. It's true today. This was true 100 years ago.
Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. Let's do a full hour sometime. Happy Election Day.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to join you, Kathleen.
Yeah, delighted to have you with us. Professor Marcelo Suarez Orozco, he's Dean and Distinguished Professor of Education at UCLA and is from Venezuela, where he couldn't vote. You know, you got to remember that on Election Day, there are places where people can't vote, and here we can vote. Today is Election Day. It's good. It's good. We're going to go to another WPR reporter. Hope Kerwin will be joining us from La Crosse, where she's been going to polls, and we'll do that in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're going around the state during these 2 hours talking to reporters. Hope Kerwin is WPR's news reporter in La Crosse, and she hosts the regional talk show Newsmakers. She covers agriculture issues, and she has spent the morning in various polling places and taking some interesting pictures as well. Hope, thank you very much for being with us. Happy Election Day.
Hi, thank you so much.
Yeah, so how are things in La Crosse? Lots of votes, a lot of early votes?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a good turnout at all the polling places that I showed up to, and it didn't seem to be too long of lines either. The first place I went to was at UWL, and I actually talked to one of the election officials there, and, you know, she actually said that she was so surprised that so many students had already, you know, registered and were really prepared with what they, you know, needed to, the identification they needed to have to vote, and, you know, it seems like things are really going smoothly in La Crosse.
Really? Well, now in the midterms, that wasn't the case. People had problems with photo IDs, and it was really problematic. You're finding that's not the case. There aren't a lot of people at tables saying, you know, I don't have the right thing I'm supposed to have here. People know what the story is. What's up, huh?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, people are very adamant about wanting to be able to vote in this election and have, you know, done their homework and have showed up prepared. You know, I talked to one person who registered at the polls today and, you know, had said that she hadn't voted in the primaries and so she, you know, wasn't registered before, but, you know, she had everything she needed and had made sure to do her research beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Did you see a lot of young people, a lot of young voters in La Crosse?
Yeah, there definitely seem to be a lot of young people out, you know, just the places that I happen to visit. You know, people like excited about casting their first ballot. But, you know, I also talked to one college student who said that, you know, she wasn't exactly happy with who she voted for this election, but, you know, felt like her vote, you know, it was very important that she voted regardless of that.
Mm-hmm. So the numbers we have, I don't know if they're updated from you or not, more than 658 people had voted at UW La Crosse, 475 people have voted at the public library. Do those numbers seem high to you, and are there a lot of locations in La Crosse?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely several. Those were just, you know, two of the ones that I'd visited. And, you know, 658, that was at, you know, 10 a.m. this morning. So I'm sure there are many more, you know, ballots cast. And, you know, there are 13 polling places in the city of La Crosse total. So, yeah, it definitely seems like people are turning out. And I'm sure as, you know, the workday ends, we'll also see another big surge of people.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to be looking for anything in particular, any counties maybe outside La Crosse, as you watch and listen to returns tonight?
La Crosse County tends to go a little more Democratic in presidential elections, and I don't think that people are necessarily thinking that we'll stray. I mean, who knows at this point? And, you know, I don't know that there are any wild cards, per se, in this area.
Mm-hmm. Hope, thank you so much for being with us.
Have a good
night.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hope Kerwin, WPR's news reporter in La Crosse, and we thank her. Later in the second hour, Glenn Moberg will be joining us from Wausau, traditionally Republican area of the state, and Rich Kramer will join us from Eau Claire to find out what turnout is like and if there have been any problems in those parts of the state. We also want to remind you that tomorrow, if you can believe it, we're going to talk about who won. Isn't that something? And we'll have a lot of people with us. Craig Gilbert will be here. Craig's been a stalwart and has written terrific pieces about Wisconsin, including today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Sean Johnson will join us. A Trump supporter from Florida will be with us, and national reporters as well. All of that coming up tomorrow starting at 1. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers and Marika Saval and KP Whaley.